Hey, all Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all. Hey, all Scott here. The thing is, I need you guys to help me to get these download numbers up. So do me a favor and sign up for the podcast feeds of this show. You can choose the whole show or just the interviews at iTunes and Stitcher. All the buttons you need are at the top of the right margin at scotthorton.org. The more subscribers I have, the more iTunes and Stitcher will help promote the show to new listeners. If you're a hardcore fan, brand new or from way back, please leave them customer ratings and reviews, too. I'm trying to get these wars ended. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org, more than 4,000 of them going back to 2003, and sign up for the podcast feed there as well, scotthorton.org. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right, introducing Daniel Lazare, reintroducing him again, another writer from consortiumnews.com. Clinton's faulty new scheme to fight ISIS is the title of this one. Welcome back to the show, Daniel. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. I'm sorry I'm late.
No problem.
Yeah, so Hillary Clinton, boy, she's got a plan. She knows what to do. In fact, I heard a guy on NPR the other day say, you know, I like Trump, but I just don't believe he has a plan. And what this country needs is a plan. And I think Hillary Clinton has a plan. So, gotta love plans. So, there we go. She's got a plan for the Islamic State. What's she going to do?
Well, she does have a plan, but, you know, I mean, there are plans and there are plans. Anyway, Hillary's plan rests on two planks. One is an intelligence surge. No one knows what that means, but it sounds good. And the second is to knock off Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, ISIS's nominal caliph. So it's either kind of meaningless on one hand, or number on the other hand, it's a replay of her greatest hits, which is the killing of Muammar Gaddafi and the assassination of Osama bin Laden. Hillary seems to think her poll numbers go up whenever she kills an Arab, so she figures it can't hurt to kill one more. Yeah. So that's what she's aiming to do. But it will not do anything at all to roll back ISIS. In fact, ISIS and like-minded groups have only gone from strength to strength in recent years, and there's every reason to believe that trend will continue.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny that, she has promised. I mean, when Donald Trump says, look, we're going to beat ISIS in a month or two, I can't tell you my secret plan. It's pretty obvious. I mean, assuming that he is serious about achieving those ends, he's talking about sending in the 3rd Infantry Division or the U.S. Marine Corps to go in there and sack Mosul and sack Raqqa and announce to these guys, your state does not exist anymore. Otherwise, there's no other way to do that, really. Unless Obama's already taken care of it for him by backing the Peshmerga and the Iraqi Shiites by January.
Well, I think that that Trump's policy, I mean, assuming I understand it correctly, is a little bit better than that. I mean, I think that at the root of his policy is the idea of making common cause with the Russians and putting aside for the moment, the Assad question. And I think that actually makes a modicum of good sense.
Well, let's talk about Syria in a second, I guess. I mean, we're starting off more on the Iraq side of this, but it is one Islamic State between the two now, is true. But
right.
In terms of sacking Mosul, which is, you know, that's what really made the caliphate, right? Ruling Raqqa was ruling Raqqa, but ruling Raqqa and Mosul is what made it the Islamic State,
sure,
with a real landmass there. So whatever happens, obviously the situation in Syria is that much more complicated. But I was really I mean, that's still just my guess, and who knows what Trump means about anything as far that goes.
Right,
but
right.
It sounds like his secret plan is he's going to, and he's actually said before, I'm going to find Patton. I'm going to find the meanest general who wants to go in there and knock the hell out of these guys. We're going to go in there and knock the hell out of these guys. That doesn't sound like any kind of ban on ground troops. Whereas Hillary has, of course, ignored the 6,000-something SOCOM and JSOC and CIA and Mercs and whoever else are already there. And said she promises, which this kind of scares the hell out of me, no ground troops ever again, she said. Which, boy, she said that, it made me think we're going to be up to 200,000, you know, I don't know. But that's at least her vow for her plan to tackle the Islamic State. So if that's really the case, then, you know, kind of as you're saying, really all she's got is a decapitation strike? And that's supposed to accomplish what exactly?
It won't accomplish anything. In fact, in the past, the problem has only grown worse with each such murder. Al-Qaeda really seemed to be on the ropes back in 2011. But since then, they've come back stronger than ever, and ISIS has also added to the.
You could even argue that killing bin Laden helped lead to the rise of the Islamic State right there, because Baghdadi wouldn't obey Zawahiri, but he still claimed Osama, who was dead, and couldn't contradict it.
Right, and also Osama, by this point, was kind of, you know, out of touch. He wasn't much use to the movements, and they knocked him off. They gave him a martyr. And the meanwhile, they ensured a steady supply of Al-Qaeda recruits via their other policies. So it won't do any good. It might actually make things worse. I mean, I'm not trying to put up a defense of Osama bin Laden or any of these other guys. I mean, al-Baghdadi's a really bad guy, and, you know, and no decent person will shed a tear over his demise. But the point is, the phenomenon is they're not addressing the issue at hand, and the issue at hand is how U.S. policies encourage the growth of these forces. I mean, these forces have mushroomed around the world since 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean,
even since 2011.
Right. 2011, but since the start of the war on terror, these forces have grown, you know, have expanded, you know, dramatically. So you would think that somebody would sit down and say, like, now, well, what are we doing wrong? But they're not.
Yeah.
And that's just the amazing thing. They're not. They're just going on the same course. They're just mind dead. It's astonishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we just saw assassination by drone of the leader of the Taliban in the Afghan Taliban hiding out in Pakistan. And that's led to the rise of a new guy who apparently he's an older guy, not a young buck, but he commands a lot more respect than his predecessor and has, you know, apparently, and I guess apparently in italics, decided that any previous talk of peace negotiations with the unity government in Kabul are off, and started attacking inside Kabul almost immediately. So, and we just see this over and over again. Same thing when they killed Zarqawi, and that's what led to Baghdadi. They kill Gaddafi, that leads to the rise of the Islamic State. Insert. They wage this kind of half-assed, at least, regime change against Assad all this time. That's led to the rise of Jalani and Baghdadi there, al-Qaeda, and then the break off the Islamic State. So killing Baghdadi, I don't know if you saw this one, but Giorgio Caffiero has one at Al Monitor from yesterday that is called Meet the Likely Successor of Islamic State's Baghdadi. And it's about this Turkish guy, Adnani, who is the second in command and chief propagandist, who is likely to be that much worse.
Yeah, he's not Turkish. His first name is Turkey.
He's actually
a Bahraini. And Bahrain is Bahrain's a really good example of what is wrong here. Bahrain, I mean, in case you don't know, is a small island kingdom of 1.4 million people located across a 16-mile causeway in the Persian Gulf across from Saudi Arabia. It's a 60% Shiite majority, but the all political power is in the hands of an absolute Sunni dictatorship. The situation there is poisonous. Arab Spring demonstrations broke out in February 2011. They were they were savagely crushed by a, you know, with the help of Saudi troops. The administration, Obama and Clinton, barely raised a peep, and then their whatever protests they made were then grew dimmer and dimmer in ensuing years. In point of fact, Bahrain hopped on the anti-ISIS bandwagon, but while at the same time pursuing Sunni extremist policies at home, which have encouraged the growth of pro-ISIS sentiment inside the kingdom. So Bahrain, you know, claims to fight ISIS abroad while encouraging it at home. Its security forces are riddled with ISIS supporters, and the U.S. goes along with it. And then it wonders why ISIS grows stronger and stronger. This guy Cafiero made the very good point that if this guy Adnani does take power in ISIS in the event that al-Baghdadi is someday knocked off, that it could represent, it could lead to a redirection of ISIS activities away from Syria and reconcentrating on the Persian Gulf itself, which means that terrorism could then explode in the heart of the world's oil region. It would represent a significant escalation in the problem. It would be just a very bad development, and yet the U.S. is contributing to this outcome. It's intentionally stirring the hornet's nest.
Yeah, well, and you know, here's the thing too: is you know, there's this whole far enemy, near enemy argument that's been taking place inside the you know, al-Qaeda and proto-al-Qaeda movement for 25 years now. And the Zawahiri bin Laden angle was, let's focus on the U.S. because, after all, how can we be successful in creating our caliphate in the Middle East or even sustaining one in Afghanistan, for that matter, as long as the American superpower is out to get us and is willing to back our local dictatorships that we want to overthrow. It's too much money and power on our enemy's side, so we got to focus on the Americans first. So Baghdadi, this is what Zawahiri argued to Baghdadi, and Baghdadi said, no, screw you, I want my caliphate right now. Well, so what happens when we destroy it? All we do is we prove Zawahiri and bin Laden right, that you have to keep attacking the Americans because they will keep attacking you, and they have to be the center of the effort until they finally are so bankrupt that they have to really withdraw from the Middle East altogether, and only then can we fight our, you know, local jihads and this and that, whatever. So what does that mean? It means that basically, just like this whole time, our government is still basically playing from the script that our enemies wrote. That's why I'm a reverse 9/11 truther. I think that George Bush and Barack Obama worked for Osama all this time.
Well, I don't know if they worked for Osama, but they certainly played footsie with the guy for a long time. And 9/11 was a hugely spectacular case of blowback. You know, these debates that go on inside al-Qaeda and ISIS are kind of like, no, I wouldn't get too hung up on them, because whether you strike at the distant enemy or the near enemy, the event, you know, eventually it's all the same thing. I mean, al-Qaeda was striking at the inside Saudi Arabia at the same time it was striking at the U.S. And the Saudis' aim was to push al-Qaeda away from the kingdom, so they would cause trouble in someone else's backyard. And the U.S.'s policy was really very similar, to push it away from the U.S. so it would cause trouble in some other part of the world where the U.S. didn't mind if a few bombs went off. But the point is, the real point, the source of the real source of the problem are these Sunni sectarian states, these bigoted, backward, absolutist states with way too much oil money on their hands, and which are breeding chaos and trying to export it, essentially, to preserve their own peace and quiet. And that is what the Saudis are doing, the Bahrainis are doing, the Qataris, et cetera, et cetera. They're trying to push their problems off on somebody else. eventually the strategy breaks down because their problems come back to bite them in the ass. But the point is that's what they're trying to do. And the U.S., by partnering with these countries, is aiding in this process. So that's why the problem gets worse and worse, because the U.S. has made itself a party to these sectarian countries, which are waging war in Syria and Yemen and any other place they can get their hands on.
All right, now, so the story goes that America's allies are backing, you know, militants of some description in Syria, Ahrar al-Sham, and then maybe they'll concede that, yeah, okay, Nusra ends up sharing weapons with the Free Syrian Army and Ahrar al-Sham and these other groups. And then maybe you'll even get admissions that, yeah, you know, you can find the Turks really working directly with the al-Nusra Front. But the story goes that once Baghdadi broke off from Jilani, or especially once his forces sacked Mosul and declared the caliphate, that at that point, even Saudi and Turkey and everybody quit backing, that faction of al-Qaeda in Iraq, basically, and we declared war on them. We've been bombing them. Certainly the U.S. Has been bombing them since 2014. I just saw Joel Wing on Twitter said today's the anniversary, the two-year anniversary of the start of the U.K.'s bombing of the Islamic State in especially in Iraq, more than in Syria. But still, I wonder whether you can tell me whether, oh, and I should add one more thing. Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer, used to be stationed in Turkey and still vacations there and goes there, told me, I think circa 2013, that he was there and he saw guys raising money for ISIS in the street right there with police protection, you know, allowing them to do it. But I wonder how much you think that's changed or whether it really has at all, or whether even is the more extreme view would be that the Islamic State itself is still basically a project of the Saudi government.
It's hard to know, but I mean, first of all, the U.S. was happy to bomb ISIS in Iraq. It had a very different policy in Syria, where its policy was to actually hold off whenever ISIS engaged in combat with Syrian government forces. So when ISIS converged on Palmyra in May 2015, I believe it was, the U.S. actually held off bombing, even though they would have been perfect targets as they made their way across miles of open desert. So the U.S. Attitude towards ISIS was hostile in Iraq and tolerant in Syria, where they were happy to see ISIS make life miserable for Assad. Every other country has adopted a similarly ambivalent policy. I mean, Turkey has been wide open in its tolerance of ISIS, and even now, strange things are happening. And with regard to Turkey's incursion in northern Syria, where ISIS seems to melt away whenever Turkish forces approach. Well, why is that? I mean, why did ISIS put up a stiff fight against the Kurdish YPG, but then sort of quietly backs off when the Turks come into view? Is it because there's some kind of deal going on between ISIS and Turkey? That's what it appears to be. And with regard to the Saudis and the other Persian Gulf states, yes, they officially oppose ISIS. But these countries are sort of long-term practitioners of hedging their bets. In other words, they fight ISIS on one hand and then try to buy them off on the other hand. So I think it's reasonable to assume that large amounts of private donations are going from the Persian Gulf states, especially Kuwait, where the scene is really unregulated, are flowing from the Persian Gulf states and finding their way into ISIS's pockets and also into al-Nusra as well. And, of course, al-Nusra gets lots of aid from the U.S. via groups like al-Sham, which work hand in glove with al-Nusra, coordinate the battlefield, intermingle with them in the battlefield, and share weapons with them in the battlefield. So in the U.S., the U.S. gives al-Sham a TOW missile, that TOW missile will wind up in Al Nusra's hands.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, everyone's playing a double game here, which is another reason why Al Nusra is able to benefit.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
You drink coffee, I drink coffee, just about everyone drinks coffee. So why bother with anything but the best? Darren's coffee is roasted at his new shop in Claremont, Indiana. And coming soon, you can order on Amazon and support the show by using Scott Horton's affiliate link. Darren'sCoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
Right. When Joe Biden, he got up at Harvard and he gave his big talk where he basically conceded 9/10 of what you're saying here, right? Our allies went crazy backing all these rebels in Syria, and sometimes they were backing some really bad dudes, which he didn't quite come right out and say Al-Qaeda in Iraq and then eventually what became ISIS.
He actually did say Al-Nusra.
My question for you then is, if all our allies are doing that, and America's saying, oh, well, we're back in the FSA, and they're moderate, and yeah, they work with al-Nusra sometimes, but we're definitely not giving guns to al-Nusra. But if all our allies are, then, you know, I asked Flint Leverett this back in 2012 or something, like, hey, isn't this just plausible deniability? Like when Reagan had Israel sell TOW missiles to Iran, nobody questions whether that was Reagan selling missiles to Iran just because they used Israel as a cutout. It's not plausible deniability, right? It's just deniability, and we can see right through it. Because otherwise, well, this is, I guess, the real crux of the matter. Could not Barack Obama, could he not have this whole time informed the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, the Kuwaitis, the Bahrainis, whoever, that I know you hate Assad and Iran, but we hate Al-Qaeda more, and we're the empire, not you, and you are going to not back Al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria because we say so, and wouldn't that have been effective? And clearly he hasn't tried that this whole time, right?
Yes, absolutely right. But it would have been effective, but it would have caused a crisis in the empire. And Barack Obama doesn't want to do that. I mean, Barack Obama is in his own way a very conservative guy, and he wants to maintain the empire as is. He doesn't want to rock the boat. So therefore, I mean, all of America's key allies in the region, Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, all want Assad to go. And so therefore, Obama can't say no to this. And this is why the fighting has been so confused, because by calling for Assad's overthrow, the U.S. can't help but wind up collaborating with those forces that are most militarily most effective in fighting for that end.
Right. And see, this is...
So therefore the U.S. finds itself, you know, sort of like, you know, twisted up in a knot of its own devising.
Right. Yeah, this is the part that the American people, like at large, I guess, are never going to be able to get their head around, that the terrorists who attacked us aren't from the axis of evil enemy states that we're at war with. They attacked us because we are too close of allies to the evil kings that rule over them. And that's why they attacked us. But so we stayed allies with those same states. And when we use their proxy armies, guess who we're talking about? We're talking about the same guys who hit our towers.
This is the whole point. The point is the U.S. has used these forces, has made common cause these forces, and it can't stop doing it. It can't stop doing it. It's like, you know, it's like a drunk who just can't stay off the bottle. You know, so the U.S., you know, relied on Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-like forces in the years leading up to 9/11, and then when the Twin Towers collapsed in a heap of dust and 3,000 people were killed, the U.S. swore off forever and ever. But the next day, what was it doing? It was going, you know, it was rummaging through the liquor cabinet looking for another bottle. It can't stay away from these forces, and that's what it's doing now in Syria. It finds itself aligned with al-Nusra, and even to a degree ISIS, no matter how hard it swears that it will no longer keep doing that.
Yep.
It really is like, you know, it's just a drunk who can't help drinking.
Well, you know, it's funny, too, when you look at the disaster of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq and basically turning the entire western half of that country into bin Ladenistan, you know, jihadistan, and battle experience and a whole new generation of radicalized fighters from Iraq War II that just never had to be whatsoever. But then Obama took their side deliberately. That's the thing. You know, what George Bush did, he thought it was supposed to be easy because Richard Perle told him it was going to be easy or whatever. And so what he did, you know, 1,000 times bin Laden's dream come true with his invasion of Iraq. Obama outright, right after murdering, right at the same time he's killing bin Laden, decapitating him like a Hillary plan. Boy, does she take credit for it, right? I'm the one who made Obama do it. Right at the same time he's killing Osama, he's siding with all of Zarqawi's men in Libya. All the veterans of al-Qaeda in Iraq, he sides with them in their uprising against Muammar Gaddafi. And where the really the Sunni tribes of Iraq, more than anyone else, had put al-Qaeda back on life support, Obama brought them right back to life again, like Frankenstein's monster. It's almost impossible to believe, except I've been following the story so closely this whole time.
Yes, yeah, so what happened in Libya is that in order to get better street, you know, for better greater credibility, the U.S. felt that it had to enlist a major Arab power in the bombing campaign against Gaddafi. So Hillary went to work on Qatar, even though Qatar has a long-standing record of support for the Muslim Brotherhood and even of al-Qaeda. So after about 2 weeks of negotiations, Al Thani, the emir of Qatar, agreed to join the bombing campaign. And in fact, Obama welcomed him to the White House and fawned all over him, and said what a great thing he was doing. So what Al Thani did is he sent jet fighters, but he also distributed as much as $400 million to anti-Gaddafi ground forces in Libya. And those ground forces were exclusively fundamentalist, Salafist, Sunni forces. And so what happened is that al-Thani wound up fueling the same Salafist forces that then proceeded to tear the country apart and reduce it to chaos. But he was brought in there at U.S. behest, with U.S. encouragement every step of the way. So Obama wound up sowing the seeds of that destruction. And Hillary did as well.
Yeah. And we know from the emails that Sidney Blumenthal, who helped, you know, encourage her to do this, also told her very early on in the war, when there still could have been a compromise, that, hey, there are jihadis and they're rounding up and murdering blacks, for one thing. We know that he was telling her that.
Yes, and in fact, but the U.S. didn't even dare remonstrate with Qatar for years after. So beholden is it to these regimes. I mean the interim government in Libya was begging Washington to tell Qatar to stop fueling these forces, but the U.S. couldn't say a word until 3 or 4 years after. It couldn't muster the gumption, the courage to do so, and the same policy has been repeated in Syria, where these forces have come in, and the U.S. has semi encouraged, semi discouraged, adopted a very gray zone attitude. They've come in and have fueled the most dangerous, vicious, head chopping, fundamentalist forces. In the name of fighting for democracy and the overthrow of an evil dictator, and these forces include al-Qaeda and ISIS. So once again, the U.S. finds itself on the same side as these groups. So what does the whole war on terror amount to? I mean, it's a great smokescreen where the U.S. winds up, you know, winds up in bed with Al-Qaeda rather than fighting it.
Yeah. Well, it's a hell of a legacy. You know, you talk about how Obama's just concentrating on his legacy. I mean, it's high treason. I mean, Bush's treason was horrible, but mostly accidental, right? I mean, he fought the Iraq war for Iran, mostly, and they're not really an enemy of ours. So as much as that was a really bad move, all the benefit to Al-Qaeda was an unintended side effect of his really bad move. But what Obama has done is directly constitutional definition provided aid and comfort to the enemy of the United States of America and the American people.
I don't want to let George Bush off the hook too easily. I mean,
I'm not saying he's not a war criminal, but I'm just saying he never, I don't think what he did was directly on behalf of Osama. It just turned out that way, right?
Well, yes, but he engaged in a massive cover up of the Saudi role, a massive cover up.
That's true.
And I think the entire Iraq war, the entire invasion, was in some sense a conscious diversion. An attempt to distract attention from the Saudi role.
Hey, let me ask you this, Daniel. Tell me what you know about Saudi support for Al-Qaeda in Iraq and or the Sunni-based insurgency during Iraq War II, when Bush had the Army and Marine Corps fighting on the side of the Iranians and their Badr Brigade.
I think that's clear that Persian Gulf money was flowing to Al-Qaeda forces and similar forces in Iraq.
That is the biggest and least covered story of the early 2000s right there. Not just because you just got to walk back from where we are now, right? We see, hey, Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria sure as hell is a Saudi project. So now let's rewind 10 years. In 2006, when American boys are being blown apart fighting in the Triangle of Death, they were fighting against their Saudi allies?
But you have to understand how Saudi Arabia works. I mean, first of all, number one is that Saudi Arabia is a huge money machine. It's got literally, it's had literally trillions of dollars in oil revenues over the years. And even now, in a straitened circumstance, it still has, I think, around $500 billion in foreign reserves. And essentially, the Saudi regime lives and dies by the checkbook. I mean, whenever there's a problem, it tries to solve it by writing a check. You know how liberals used to be accused of throwing money at problems? Well, that's what the Saudis do, a thousand times greater scale. So if a mujahideen is causing problems, threatening to set off a bomb in your backyard, you write him a check and tell him to go away. And, you know, he will go away for a little while. And if the Sunnis are getting their ass kicked in Syria, well, then everyone knows that fighting for the Sunnis is a good deed according to Wahhabist Islam. And so therefore, you know, what you do is you salve your conscience by writing a check for the Sunni Mujahideen in Iraq. And you do that in Syria, you do that in Yemen, you do that all over the place. So that's how Saudi Arabia works. It writes checks. Mm-hmm. And so yes, I mean, the Saudis have been funding these activities not only in Syria and Iraq, but, you know, but in Bosnia and Chechnya and many other places in the world as well. They are a huge, you know, bankroll for Sunni extremism. That's what, you know, Hillary wrote in a internal State Department memo on Christmas Day. I think it was Christmas Day or was it New Year's Eve in 2009, when she described Saudi Arabia as the greatest source of support for Sunni terrorism throughout the world. Thanks, you know, to Wikipedia to WikiLeaks, that memo is now public information. But yes, I mean Saudi Arabia is a great big money spigot.
Mm-hmm. And we know from
the money goes to these forces.
And the Financial Times has this great quote of Prince Saud al-Faisal saying directly to John Kerry, as though Kerry's not in on it, Daesh is our response to your support for the Dawa. And that means the government of Iraq that the U.S. has installed in Iraq War II, the last three prime ministers there, all from the Dawa party, Abadi, Maliki, and Jafari before him.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of something called the resource curse?
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, the resource curse is the idea that that whenever you discover a resource like gold or oil or whatever, you create a kind of a create a giant rentier economy where people make money not by working but by sort of living off the proceeds. And rentier economies are invariably they encourage laziness. They encourage corruption, and they also encourage violence. Nigeria, for example, is a primary victim of the resource curse. It's one of the most corrupt and internally most violent countries on the face of the earth. And the Saudis are yet another example. They have solved their internal violence problem by exporting it to neighboring countries. But Saudi Arabia is a corrupt, anti-labor state where all the work is done by foreign workers who are brought in on virtually slave labor circumstances, and they breed violence that they then export onto neighboring countries. And the U.S., of course, is intimately involved in this process. I mean, this is the great partnership that has grown up over the last 40 years. Following the first oil shock. And now, thanks to JASTA and a few other events, it's finally coming undone. Mm-hmm. But its unwinding will be every bit as traumatic as it's building up.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so let's wrap up with that, because JASTA is huge. This is important. It's the only time in Obama's entire administration that his veto has been overridden by a supermajority of both houses of Congress. But now they're already backing down, and they're saying they're going to rewrite the law they just passed, Daniel. Well, first of all, so tell us what JASTA is, and then let us know what you think of what's going to happen.
JASTA is the Justice for the Justice. Well, tell me, what does it stand for, Scott? Is it Justice?
It's that you're allowed to sue the Saudis, and we won't throw your suit out and call it Sovereign Immunity Act.
Right, precisely right. So JASTA essentially gives 9,000. I think it's 6,000 9/11 survivors the right to sue Saudi Arabia for their alleged involvement in the destruction of the World Trade Center, and it's just elementary justice. And the suit wouldn't have been necessary if the Washington government had been sincerely interested in obtaining justice for these victims. But of course, it wasn't. I mean, the whole world was transfixed by these bodies falling out of the World Trade Center. It was horrible. All these innocent people plunging to their deaths. I mean, the carnage is almost unimaginable. But the government, which is allegedly the democratic government of by and for the people, didn't really care. They were more interested in covering up the reasons for that disaster and going after parties that were completely uninvolved, such as Saddam Hussein, than they were at achieving justice for the victims. And that's why JASTA is necessary. But Obama has only himself to blame. If he had really pursued justice, this lawsuit would never have taken place. But because he didn't, he now has a huge problem on his hands.
Mm-hmm. And now, what do you think about Mitch McConnell saying, well, don't worry, we're going to rewrite it? Trent Lott came to town, and he's a lobbyist for Saudi and former GOP majority leader of the Senate, and he let us know that we're going to have to rewrite this thing because forget that.
Well, hopefully they won't get away with it. It's just really sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Think how amazing it was that they overrode Obama's veto for this thing. And then it makes you wonder whether that was all just an act so they could go back and rewrite it later, or Trent Lott really only found out later. You know, Mitch McConnell actually said, the majority leader of the Senate said, well, Obama didn't make a compelling enough case of what was wrong with the legislation.
Yeah, but
he vetoed it,
But bear in mind, I mean, JASTA only takes aim with the Saudis, and the real problem is here in the U.S. and JASTA won't touch that.
No, of course.
I mean, it's the real in this partnership. There's this U.S. Saudi partnership. There's no question as to which party was dominant. That was the U.S. So, you know, so I'm not saying the U.S. blew up, you know, the Twin Towers by wiring them from within or any nonsense like that. But the U.S. deserves primary responsibility for that disaster. But JASTA will only go after the secondary party.
Yeah. And well, you know what, though? If we can get Bandar all strung up there and he wants to start accusing Dick Cheney of leaving doors open and eyes blind, then I'll listen.
I agree totally, Scott. I agree totally.
All right. So, hey, listen, I love interviewing you, Danny. You did great work, man.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for coming back on the show. Appreciate it.
Sure. See you soon. Bye-bye.
All right, so that's Daniel Lazare. He wrote The Frozen Republic, How the Constitution is Paralyzing Democracy. You know what? I'm for repealing Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, if we could start there. That's my proposed amendment. This one is called Clinton's Faulty New Scheme to Fight ISIS. A really great one at Consortium News and in great company there, of course, as well. That's Scott Horton's show. Check out scotthorton.org for the archive. Sign up for the podcast feed there. Help support at scotthorton.org/donate and follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.